Last time the problem of man, particularly the question of the individual versus the community, as it was formulated by classical philosophy. Basically, when classical philosophy spoke about the individual, it was not a relationship to the community, but to mankind. Classical philosophy didn't know the concept of community. It's mankind, the universal, universal. And all these concepts, community and state, were simply, not known, to the classical philosophy as the concepts are known to us. Basically, in Greek, they didn't even have the concept of state. It was more a city government on the time. Then I tried to derive from the theory of the individual certain practical conclusions. So I tried to interpret the Greek philosophy of man in moral and also in social terms, as the social welfare and so forth. Of course, we have to pick up the problem of the Jewish, as the individual within Judaic thought. But before I'm going to pick up this problem today, but before I do it, I would like again to see how this classical influence has asserted itself in modern philosophy with regard to the individual versus the community. When I say modern philosophy, I don't mean modern philosophy in the sense of contemporary philosophy, but more modern philosophy since the Age of Enlightenment or the Age of Reason, since the French Revolution about that time. Or perhaps tracing it back to the English positivism, like Hume, Locke, and so forth. In order to place the classical view of man in focus and to appreciate the enormous influence, and I'm doing it for the sake of contrasting the modern approach with that of the Jewish approach. Because when we say individual, the very concept of individual is very vague, and we can interpret individual in two different ways. And to appreciate the enormous influence it exerted, the classical view of man upon the emergence of modern theory, and in order also to assess properly the significance of the revolutionary doctrine of man in Judaism, it would be advisable for us to investigate the controversy in modern philosophy relative to the problem of individual versus the community. Basically, there are two doctrines as regards this relationship, between individual and community. And in the course of this lecture, I'll show the Judaism disagrees, and I may add the adverb violently with both theories. But let us first see, these two opposite viewpoints, and also, realize that Judaism cannot accept either of them. Basically, there are two doctrines as regards the relationship between the individual and the community. The individualistic doctrine and the positivist, or also the idealist. The first theory, which is found its most succinct expression in the philosophy of the Enlightenment or the Age of Reason, says, the individual being is an independent entity, provided with natural prerogatives and in its rights. He enjoys full aboriginal freedom and is endowed with creative aptitude for which he is not indebted to anyone, since he is the originator of everything. Of course, reading, for instance, the Declaration of Independence, you'll find the echo of this individualistic theory in the Declaration of Independence. At the beginning, if I may use a biblical phrase for that, at the beginning, there was the individual, not the time. Later came the community, the collective, which is to be understood in terms of isolated individuals who joined up and formed a society. The latter consists of single selves who retain
their autonomy, even after they have left their solitary abodes and united within a community. The individual is capable of managing his affairs without appealing for aid to the collective. He is self-sufficient. The I does not need the Tao or the He. Of course, the meeting of all three, that means of the I, the Tao and the He, and their coalescence into society, makes life simpler and more comfortable. Yet an individual isolated existence is quite thinkable and also possible. It is for a very good reason that the doctrine of individualism, who was told by theologians, a Robinson Crusoe philosophy. And Dilthey, the famous German social philosopher, and Brunner, the Swiss theologian, have already pointed out that this theory, granting primacy to the individual and isolating him from the social texture into which he was woven, coincides with the attempt of classical physics and chemistry to atomize matter and to interpret holes or processes in nature in terms of particles and isolated entities. It coincides with the conceiving of big events as resultant of infinitesimal sub-appearances. This is exactly what physics does. So taking the community, atomize the community, and interpret community in terms of the individual. Interpretation of the macrocosmos as the sum total of microcosms. Yes, and wisely I throw this theory, it's well known to you. I'm advancing nothing new, because people I read lately, the people identify this theory with the Judaic viewpoint. This is exactly what it is. This is not the Judaic viewpoint. Whether individual thing, first a different problem, but the individual is self-sufficient, completely annihilated existence, and the community is something which appeared later, either by the naive concept of contact social, which is a very naive concept, or because of certain other forces which made individuals coalesce into community. This is not a Jewish viewpoint. This is neither a Jewish viewpoint. Of course, the opposite view of the individualistic theory is the theory of idealism, which is directly influenced by the classical theory of man, which places man within some ideal supra-individual system. The individual is placed into a supra-individual system. The individual existence can only be understood if looked upon as a manifestation of an all-embracing higher entity, be it the class, be it mankind, and these also, as Hegel wants to say, the objective spirit. The individual, the single person, vanishes behind the universe, the whole, the general. Whatever the individual is, whatever he possesses, his ability, attitude, creative talent, his experiences of a full existence, is rooted in the supra-individual unity of entity, which avails itself of the single person as an instrument as manifesting something higher and greater. I don't want to go into detail as to the different schools which deny the autonomy of the individual and see only a medium through which something more worthy expresses itself. There are many schools. Important is only their general contention that the individual is only part of the whole. Whether this view is formulated in universalistic Hegelian terms, or in the accent of the romantic theory of organic growth, like Herder and so forth, or in the positivistic, materialistic verbiage of Marxism, and its class doctrine is irrelevant. What is significant is the conclusion that the individual serves the collective, while the individualistic doctrine of man maintains that the reverse is true. It's very usual to say not that the state serves the individual.
Of course.
It's very simple to say within its totalitarian system that the reverse is true, that the individual serves the state. Judaism could not identify itself with either of these doctrines. We will see later why. So when I said, when I developed class time, and see the class theory of man, man is only a representative of the of mankind, so of course, so you might have thought that the reverse would be, so to say, subscribed to by Judaism, to the individualistic theory. This is exactly what I want to get out, so to say. The Judaism does not subscribe to the individualistic theory, as it has been formulated by the philosophers of Asia, reason, and so forth. Judaism has a very peculiar approach to that. I just introduced these two theories. There are many more, between, but in order to show the concept. What I want to say is now to try to develop is the Judaic interpretation of man, in particular, his relationship to the community. Question, is the individual autonomous? Is the community supra-individualistic entity to which he must feel committed? Or on the contrary, there is no commitment on the part of the individual to the community. In contradistinction to these two basic views, basic anthropological philosophical views, Judaism has introduced a new idea of man. Let us move forward. Answering the question which intrigues the finest minds, namely, what is man? Or rather, as I said last time, what is the distinctive element in man? We'll find that Judaism has two distinctive elements in that. Perhaps three. But we'll discuss now just one, the first one, which I believe is the most important. So he said, in Greek philosophy, the answer was the intellect. I showed you in my monitor, in the guide, in the first chapter, when it speaks about Salem, my mind is also about this viewpoint that man is distinct by his intellect. Because by his rational ability and capacity to understand himself and to understand his environment. And finally to somehow subject the environment to his own, so to say, his own plans or ideas. Yeah. This is Judaism, basic genuine Judaism, unadulterated, I would say, by any philosophical jargon or any extremist influence, but pristine. And between you and me, basically pristine Judaism, where is the source if you want to get that? Or I would say medieval philosophy of religion, of course medieval philosophy of religion, Jewish religion, it was written by great scholars, Maimonides, Halevi, Sa'adia, Bachian, Yalcinides, and so forth. But unfortunately, they were children of their time. And their time was moving in the orbit of the great philosophy. Greek, colored by Neoplatonic mysticism. It's a combination of Aristotelianism and Neoplatonic mysticism. Even my mind as a rationalist is also a mystic. Because this was, so to say, the climate of the time. The rationalist on the one hand, and mystic on the other. And Maimonides, you never know where Maimonides is, the Jewish scholar, where the Greek, the disciples of Aristotle and Plotinus. It's hard to know. Sometimes you deal with Maimonides, the Jewish scholar, and in a second, he vanishes and is replaced by an Aristotelian. It's hard to know sometimes. That's why the sources are not too reliable. Basically, there's only one source which is very reliable, and this is the Halakha. The Halakha is an unadulterated source. It was very far removed from the outside world. Extremist influences did not reach the Halakha as much as they reached the philosophical mind, the Halakhic scholars. It was a group for itself. And in the Halakha, the basic Jewish viewpoint came to expression. The trouble is the Halakha, as I told you, the Halakha speaks in terms of laws, in terms of legal concepts, Halakhic categories. When you have to find a philosophical background, you get involved into a job of reconstructing out of objective data a great religious experience. It's very difficult, I told you, because it's
from the objective basis.
What?
Rules, technical rules of behavior. The passage from technical rules of behavior to a great religious experience, to the passionate religious personality, to the homo religiosus, is a very tortuous one.
But we will try our best to try to develop out of Allah's process, I mean, the theory of man. So that's when Allah abuses man, and if he formulated laws for man, and legislated norms for him, so that his head, I mean, it must have had a theory of man. Otherwise, it's an attachment. In order to register for somebody, he has to know this X. I mean, if it's unknown, and you can't solve the equation, if there is no equation, the equation is this, or the equation is the equation, the equation is insoluble, so you cannot say anything.
Now let me, I like quoting many laws. I have many laws, I mean, to corroborate what I say, and many stories. I have nice stories, but it's not a question of telling stories.
I have to bore you a while, I can't help it. It should be placed in a philosophical context.
Judaism has introduced a new idea of man.
And I'm convinced about it. I'm very, as far as claims which people make on behalf of Judaism, with regard to its participation in the emergence of culture, I'm very modest. And you should not lay claims to things which we have not contributed anything.
But however, in regard to matters that we have actually proclaimed to the world, ideas which we have actually advised the world about their existence, so you should take pride. And this is one of the ideas that Judaism gave to everyone. Answering the question which intrigues the finest mind, namely, what is man, the Bible says. And you look at me in surprise if I tell you. Man is a lonely being. And in this feeling of loneliness, the distinctness of man manifests itself.
First distinctive element in man, which sets men apart from nature, or from creation in general, is this solitude.
Call it loneliness, call it adultness, but this solitude, this separateness. Why is it lonely? Because, that's what Judaism is all about. Russia is a law answer. Each man is not only a single individual. This is not well followed. But also a singular being. Not a single being, but a singular being.
And right here is one of the reasons why Judaism could not accept the individualistic theory of man. Although Judaism believes it's individual. Because the individualistic theory of man does not speak of singular beings, but of single beings. Like atoms within physical matter. So it means each being equal to another, like two atoms. Each atom, within the particular element, they equal each other. Like two electrons, the product of the structure. A two neutrons, they equal each other. All right, okay, in the emergence of society, they said, the atom came first, concrete matter later. Concrete matter, society, is a coalescence basically of atoms, of individual atoms. But the individual is only an atom. They are all identical. The same attitude, the same creative talent, the same experiences. It is the same existential experience that's important. The same awareness. It is just atoms many. Of course, they were very gracious to say that individual is responsible for the society, not society, for the individual. But the individual itself is just one of many, or one among many. And there are many like him. There are almost an infinite number like him, like there are an infinite number of atoms. It's just atomization of society. But atomization of society does not mean restoration of the dignity of the individual. Because in order to be a dignified being, it's not enough if I say I am responsible for society. But now we don't care for you. Because if you are not here, someone else will fill the void. Someone else will replace you, will supplant. Because the same ability. That's exactly what the question is. Is it just a single individual? That's what the individualistic theory says.
get what's restored or what. It's simple, individual. And basically, when you read carefully the American, the Declaration of Independence, and Jefferson, there is no singularity of the individual. He speaks about the dignity of the individual, created in the image of man, and the force and applies the so-called legacy. The legis natura, the lex natura, the natural rights which are inherent in the individual. Yes, but individual to them is replaceable. It is personal. It's not A, it's not Mr. X, it's Mr. Y. And it's not Mr. Y, it's Mr. Z. Judaism's greatness in this regard is that the individual is not only a single being, it is a singular being. Let us continue. God created man, and I'll show you how Judaism arrived at it. Let us just take a twist from the part of Judaism. God created man in his image, the Tzelem Elokim Bahoyim. And the divine aspect in man expresses itself not so much in his intellect, I mean, the intellect of man is a bit naive, but rather spiritual and mental capabilities or attributes which the human being possesses, in contradistinction to the animal and the plant, but in his very existential experience of aloneness. It's better to say, later we'll see what's the difference between loneliness and aloneness. It's better to say that the image of God expresses itself in the fact that man is lonely or solitary, in his aloneness and otherness, in his estrangement and separateness from creation in general and from the Tao in particular. Man is lonely in regard to two. It's a two-head. He is lonely in regard to the forest, if I should find myself in the forest, or some in the woods, or in the fields. I am lonely among the trees. I am lonely among the animals. I am lonely in the jungle. Correct? This means the loneliness, which is estrangement of man from creation in general. There is also another concept of loneliness of man and experience at the social level. Man is lonely not only with regard to the forest, to the trees, to the animals, of the ocean and to the heavens. He is also lonely with regard to the Tao. I find myself at Times Square and I am a stranger, I also experience loneliness. But not loneliness, I mean, which makes me so feel my estrangement from nature, but makes me conscious of my, so to say, of the gap, or the gulf dividing me from the crowd. Why is it? So, let's not forget that Judaism is a monotheistic religion. We all know it. Our basic article of faith found expression in the opening verse to Shema. You are Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one. The word in Hebrew for one is Echad. You know what? Basically, in Hebrew, Echad means not only one. Echad in Hebrew. The feeling for the semantic aspect of the heart, in the Hebrew word, means not only one, but it means the only one. Not only one, but the only one. So basically, there would be two translations of Shema Israel, Shema Lechem, Shema Chad. It would translate it not Yiro Israel, God is our, the Lord is our God. The Lord is one, but I would say, the Lord is our God, the Lord is the only one. And of course, you can make a mathematical equation. The only one equals the lonely one. So actually, if you want to translate Israel in English, and translate properly, it would be, here to Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is lonely. French, but different. Because Echad means not only the Lord is one, but he is unique, he is the only one, he is singular. There's no friend, there's no associate.
basically Ibn Ezra, the medieval commentator of the Bible, says so.
He says the verse in the sense God being alone, not one but alone.
Even the German Jewish scholar,
one of the fathers of liberal Judaism, Tunes, Leopold Tunes, also translated this verse, not only the one, but also as unique.
God is unique. Means lonely. What does it mean, God is lonely? God is different from all other beings. He is only other than all creatures. His existence is singular and incommensurable with our existential experience. So this means, for me, lonely, only one, his existence is different from ours. In the Maimonidean philosophy, the Echad, as implying, if I may use a term, a theological term introduced by Otto, the German authority, the Numen. The Numen means the unknowability, the strangeness, the otherness. Something which is different, something which is incommensurable, incongruous with whatever I know and I experience. The Numen, the unique, incomprehensible, incommunicable, and inexpressible existence. To my mind, this incommunicability of God's existence to others, his uniqueness, his unknowability, his loneliness, his aloneness, sound the keynote of all philosophical thinking in Judaism. All according to my mind, all you may predicate of God according to my mind is his incomparability to his creation and his unknowability. This is the only attribute what you can say. What you can say about God is he's not like us. Can't say anything positive. And you know the famous doctrine of Maimonides, many call it the docta ignorantia, or negative theology, whether these terms are true is a different problem, but it means we all can know about God that he is different from us.
Now if you just, is there the guide here? Yeah, the guide? If you just be so kind, not in the guide,
first section,
and chapter 60, first section,
attributes of God,
page 88, I don't want you to believe me if my mind is there, so I mean, you'll just check on it. So, page 88.
For
it has been shown that every perception we could imagine, even if existing in God, in accordance with the opinion of those who assert the existence of attributes, would in reality not be of the same kind as that imagined by us, but would only be called by the same name according to our explanation. It would in fact amount to negation.
And you say God exists, and you want to subsume existence out of category of existence, it's a wrong statement. You can only say God exists not the way we exist. Nothing else. Or rather, if we should employ my religion phrase, he does not exist the way we exist. Negate.
Yes. Now, suppose we can skip that. You thus necessarily arrive at some negation without obtaining a true conception of an essential attribute. On the contrary, you are led to assume that there is a plurality in God and to believe that he is all one essence of several unknown attributes. For if you intend to affirm them, you cannot compare them with those attributes known by us, and they are consequently not of the same kind. You are, as it were, brought by the belief in the reality of attributes to say that God is one subject of which several things are predicated, though the subject is not like ordinary subjects, and the predicates are not like ordinary predicates, and so forth. So my mind is the whole chapter of 60 and 61 wants to show one thing. All you can say about that,
that he's not like us. So what does it mean in other words? If one is not like us, so what is it? In simple English, he's alone. Because if he's like us, he's not alone. Is there some other ability? There is something common denominator. There is something universal in both of us. It's not alone. There is nothing in common between God and creation.
Now, Judaism, the matter of fact, also spoke of God as the lonely being, abiding in seclusion, hidden in his infinite recesses, and a solitary being. And this is when you want to say a solitary being, or the only one, you can say instead of a thought, you say Yachid.
Yachid means already not one, although a thought itself involves this only one, but Yachid means the only one. And we have a passage in the Bible, in the Pentateuch. Do we have the English translation out there?
Yeah, but I'll start finding it in the one. Yes. It is with a bit of time, okay? It is Deuteronomy 32:12.
Deuteronomy 32:12. Adishem Bagat Yanchelo. Zeinimo Ileko.
The translation is a very poor one. It says, God showed them all by known the greeting, and there was no strange God within. But Badat is more, Badat is alone, not in the sense no one helps him.
But he is alone. Not in the sense no one helps him. Because if we had expressed this, it would say, Abishem Rebatal, Yanchel. But here is Badat. God, the lonely God. That is the translation. God, the lonely God. Badat, Badat is loneliness. God, Icha Yashva Badat. God, the lonely God. The lonely God lead him, and there was no strange God with him. God, the Lord, the lonely Lord, the lonely one. God is always enveloped in a cloud. Cloud of darkness. Clouds of and darkness are about him. This identification, God with the cloud, is very familiar to everybody who knows the Bible. A year that Hashem gone on, God is descended, enveloped in a cloud. Let us take for instance the Psalms 97, if I'm not mistaken. 97, the Psalms. Cloud and darkness are round about him. I mean, there is, I believe, a verse like that. 97.
He said it
was
Friday.
One of our authors. Loneliness of God, 97, yeah?
Is that 97?
Oh, no, second verse. Oh, no, 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 what else is that? Cloud and darkness are around about you, correct?
What does it mean, loneliness?
It is always the cloud as a symbol of isolation, aloofness, solitude, seclusion, withdrawal. Loneliness of God is perhaps the highest term of Judaic theological thinking. Why is it the highest term? Because it has a tremendous influence over our social philosophy. If God weren't lonely, we couldn't have developed his beautiful social philosophy. Since man was created in the image of God, his specific endowment consists in his existential loneliness. Now I'll explain later what it means. Which is an expression of his uniqueness and separateness from being as a whole. And modern psychology and psychiatry, many, have erred in their interpretation of the feeling of loneliness. It's a basic mistake. Of course, this mistake has penetrated lately theological thinking and all pastoral psychologists means who, a rabbi is not a psychologist, or a theologian is not a psychologist, or the other way around. A psychologist is neither a rabbi nor a theologian. So this combination is a very funny one. When they speak about integrating men into society, well, that's the thing. Simply trying men to help him, he should rid himself of feeling of loneliness, solitude. I mean, he is making a basic mistake. Of course, it is not always, loneliness is not always a disintegrated and devastating emotion. I say not always, sometimes yes. Later will come, the loneliness becomes a disintegrated or a disjunctive emotion of the other. Or a devastated emotion. Not always is it negative emotion indicating disturbance or frustrating experiences. Only at certain times, loneliness is engendered by mental desolation and forlornness and is indicative of a sick soul, yes, at certain times. Yet, loneliness is not only to be found in the area of morbid self-introspection, of unfounded fears, inferiority, self-loathing, and debating, or self-contempt, but also, and perhaps mainly, in a new dimension, in death of human greatness, in human dignity, and glory. Man is great and glorious because he is lonely. When the psalmist exclaims, "For thou hast made him," 8, if you don't mind, Psalm 8. We are hearing, "For thou hast made him." A little lower than the angels, you have here? You have it? "For thou hast made him a little lower than the angels," yes? It says, what verse is it? Huh? 6, yes. "For thou hast made him a little lower than the angels." Again, angels said the translation. "What chasreyu me'at melekim," does that mean the angels? Sometimes the Bible and the king is a substitute for angels, for malach. But basically, the king means in God. "You just made him a bit lower than God. And has crowned him with glory and honor." So what does it mean, a bit lower than God? It's not with regard to our capability. As far as our capabilities are concerned, we are not just a bit lower than God. And there is how the moon comes down. When it speaks about a bit lower than God, it refers to the essential experience of man. And it refers to the unique gift which was bestowed upon man, namely, his loneliness, is solitude. Of course, the feeling of solitude is a painful one, no doubt about it. Through it, man comes, through loneliness perhaps, man comes close to the reality of suffering. No doubt about it. I don't say it's a very comfortable feeling. It's a painful feeling. However, this necessity of coming close to the reality of suffering is also an opportunity to share in the travail of an inspired existence. And who knows whether one can share in the great drama of existence without subjecting oneself to pain or to suffering. Now, let us see. God is lonely. Man is lonely. Conclusion is one. It is very simple. What is the conclusion? That man draws for God, and God searches for that problem. Two lonely beings, who meet each other. Basically, the meeting, the rendezvous between man and God, because both are lonely. And how beautiful, I mean, what I know for it. Not the Jewish philosopher. Beautiful. Mm-hmm. See, finally, it's sound. What is actually religious experience? It's not the flight of the lonely to the lonely one. There's only one difference. The first family lonely is a small, and the lonely one are capitalized.
Though this is true from a Judaic viewpoint. The first approach of man to God and God's moving from his transcendence toward man manifests the paradoxical mutual fascination. The lonely finite being and the lonely infinite being are subjected to it. Man searches toward God because he is lonely, abandoned by creation, such forlorn in his seclusion and aloneness, and in order to allay his painful experience and to help or to heal his tormented mind and tortured heart, and to restore them to the health of serenity and of an existence of fellowship. And God, who is lonely, needs, because one experience combines them both. This is a strange existential experience of solitude, which man is paradoxically to escape, and which will find the thread of an existence dedicated to some ultimate end woven in the fabric of one's personality. Both, he wants to escape it, and his day is great because of this experience. Now, particular attention should be devoted to the nature of prayer, Mr. Dow. What is prayer? If Judaism didn't know the concept of loneliness, Judaism could not develop the idea of prayer. Now, it's not prayer as such is a Judaic concept. The Greeks didn't understand what prayer was. To them, prayer was more simply an aesthetic meaning. Okay. If you see something nice, you write a note.
But the Omutami wrote in Horace.
Nothing but a note. But a note is not a prayer. Because basically you know very well that the so-called hymn plays a minor role in Jewish prayer. The so-called extolling hymn, or even the thanksgiving hymn, plays a minor role. What is the main, the very core of prayer is the so-called intercessory prayer, or the petition. But many call this, because of ignorance, the selfish prayer. And I ask that to gratify my needs. But in Judaism, because the intercessory prayer is indicative of man's crisis, of man's distress. The hymn is not indicative of distress, of crisis. Because prayer in Judaism is combined, knitted very closely with tzara. Tzara means distress, when one finds himself in straits, in narrow straits. Yes, one says, I mean, when I come to Eretz Israel, I forget all my story, but I found tzara. What does tzara mean? Tzara means not calamity, I want you to understand. It's a very mistaken translation. It's not calamity, it's not catastrophe. Tzara is tzara. Tzara even means narrow. And the one finds himself in narrow straits. Mina meitza tzaratika. From the narrow straits, out of the narrow, or de profundi. And I find myself somewhere in the depths. I can't. It means the man is in crisis. It's great crisis. It is distress, but not the surface distress. It is depth distress. Distress in being itself. And this exactly drives man to God. Drives him to pray. That's why the hymn, we have the hymn, we have psalms and many hymns. But basically, 75% of all the psalms is God answer. And the repetition. I am sinner. You never get to the recommended reading I wanted you to read, I mean these psalms, in which the distress comes to expression. You're not reading the book of psalms, any psalm. Distress, I am lonely, I am poor, the people, I mean, I am forlorn, I am on the brink of nihility, I am at the brink of hell, I mean, I can't find myself, help me find myself, I am trying to escape my fate, my destiny, I mean, this is the motif, it is that it's long. If not for long, that's why Judaism has tempered, stressed, or underlined the intercessory prayer, or the so-called petition, and or the selfish prayer, as it's called by some theologians. You take a Shemen Esrei, that's a composer, not 1819, they have only six hymns, actually there are only a few, which deal with singing a hymn to God. But mostly, it's simply I specify my needs.
And again, they say I cannot specify my needs. You know my needs better than I do. So please answer.
Particular attention should be devoted to the nature of prayer. One of the most exalted religious experiences. Prayer basically is a dialogue between God and single man. An encounter between a lonely soul and its lonely creator. It's only a dialogue between two people. It's you alone. It's not a symposium. So if the community comes to God, then it is a symposium. It's more than a dialogue, I would say. And prayer is only a dialogue, a dialogue. It's a secret. Only between two. Who is the two? On the one hand is the one, yes. But on the other hand, who comes to God is not a community. He's right in there. I wouldn't argue with him. But he's wrong if he thinks that this is infantile. That the need for testing God's anguish and sorrow in the lap of God, the Father, is far from a neurotic attitude or infantile attitude on the part of frightened man. It is instead a very healthy response. Sometimes to crushing defeat and crisis. The feeling of insecurity ends many a time when security is found in the lonely down. And literally, if you want to take a look, Psalm 55, chapter 55, verse 23. Haskaich ala b'shem midi haska, b'hulichal talaka. Just take burden upon the Lord, and he shall sustain thee. Cast thy burden, 53, 55, verse 93. Cast thy burden upon the Lord, and he shall sustain thee. Will you be so kind and read the following verse? I don't have it in the manuscript, the following verse. In English, what's the following verse? Will you be so kind, 23? He will never suffer the righteous to be moved. Yes. The lonely person comes before God, men in despair and fear, kneels before him, and hides his head, bent under the heavy yoke of living, and at his bidding. Men, whom everybody has forsaken and betrayed, find shelter in God. Prayer means a feeling of being forsaken by everybody. No one understands this, not because of his fault, and not because the other fellow is wrong. Not as any culpability on the part of any fellow. No. I don't blame anybody. I don't indict anybody. Because he can't understand me. Why? Because he's lonely and he's like, I am lonely. How can two lonely beings understand each other? How can we be forsaken? That's why the individual is forsaken. It's not an indictment. Man whom everybody is forsaken and betrayed, find shelter in God. Men forfeit everything, friendship, sympathy, and understanding, on the part of others. You were the only man, clean stream.
And this means, Kirachot Kishako, that every knee bows before thee, because every knee must lose its elegance and security at one time or another.
Now, if you'll be so kind, you open the psalm again. Psalm 27. Psalm 27, verses 9 and 10.
When you read it, you'll see what prayer means.
27, read that with David. As a matter of fact, recited the whole Mount of Elul until after Shmini Atzeret. Verse 9 and 10. Hide not thy face from me. Put not thy servant away in anger. Thou hast been my help. Cast me not off, neither forsake me, O God of my salvation. For though my father and my mother have forsaken me, the Lord will take me up.
Father and mother have forsaken me. And we'll see later, it is true. It's not just a claim. It is true. I mean, it appears strange how father and mother can forsake a child. We'll see about it.
This is exactly
And that is why, and please, I'm not, please don't get me wrong, I'm not trying to preach an orthodoxy. But, I mean, now it's by the sheer fault of associated thinking, I have to mention it. That's why we offer Jews our post to mix to the family pew in the synagogue. The family pew. You know why the family pew is wrong? Why that, if I ask you why the family pew is wrong, according to our thinking, why do people want to have a family pew? Why does the American Jew want to pray together with his wife and children? He wants to feel comfortable. So he takes a look at his wife. She is a bit of light to him. The children, they wouldn't desert him, they wouldn't forsake him. They, whenever he'll be in need, he can come to his wife and children. That's exactly what they, the families, want us not to believe. That's why we fight against the family view, because we want to isolate individuals from the family, at least for an hour. And to come to God, or before God, as a lone individual, as your family, your wife, your children, your parents. You know that basically you never allow child and father to stay to sit next to each other. Because this child has to look at his father, when he has trouble, he'll come to his finite father. So there is and the basic element of prayer, the condition sine qua non, is this sentence, this verse in the psalm, ki avi vivini yazavi, father and mother, best friend, substantial friend of a man, has forsaken me. And this should be not only thought as a mental experience, but as a mental experience we have to create an environment for it, a climate for it. It's a very soft seed, and I have my wife, children around me, if I say it, I seem to be alive. This is exactly the basic philosophy of why you oppose. I mean, a lot of nonsense has been said about us. We are opposed to the fair sex, to the difference. And if one knows what the status of a woman is in Allah, I mean, can I say it? Such statements come from people either who are ignorant, simply they don't know what the station of the woman was in Allah. Oh, they're not ignorant, but it's simply this thought there. The thought is a very daring indictment, but I have to say. It has nothing to do with the question of sex. It has to do with the problem of family. Not family in the synagogue. In the synagogue, not a family comes, not a community comes. There is no community in the synagogue. It's nothing. The isolated individuals, but still, you need a place for to worship. So there is physical contiguity, so to say, in space. But mentally, each one is the world himself. And he puts upon the other one as a stranger. Not as my neighbor, as my friend. As a stranger. As one who is completely indifferent to my suffering, to my problems. To the doubts which have filled my mind. Who is completely, who has no concern for me. And there's only one friend I come to. This is God. The Lord will take me out. Now, let's continue. The humanitas of man culminates in his loneliness. The latter is not, as a rule, a devastating, but an ennobling experience, the absence of which shuts out the vision of God from one's life. And that's exactly what is wrong with the basic philosophy of peace of mind as an aim of religion. The Greek Judaism, have no right to speak about them in general. And Judaism. Of course, I see now sociology begins to affect this problem a lot of that. But basically, it's wrong that peace of mind means complete forgetting about one Christ. It means a belief that I am fully successful. Successful to the highest level. And I see many people who think they are successful in life. That men cannot be defeated. Yet he didn't suffer anything. And of course, they measured success in the seat in terms in very shallow terms. In making money on this level. Social station and social prominence and so forth. And somebody that's already. This cannot be. Gender is no need for that. At least the need is a secondary one. The flight, what I have said, of the lonely to the lonely one, can come out of this. And we Jews believe that there are two kinds of distress, two kinds of fight. one crisis we call the surface crisis.
Surface crisis?
For instance, disease, famine, war, poverty, it's a surface crisis. Because it does not touch the very existence of man. I mean, his experience as an existent, as a person, it's because it's due to certain environmental conditions. And these conditions can be alleviated and changed. And today I'm hungry, tomorrow I can have money and buy bread. Today I'm sick, tomorrow I'll recover. And so forth. This is surface crisis. Surface crisis, of course, also. I mean, a man who finds himself in this difficult crisis, I mean, runs to God. But Judaism said there is permanent sorrow. There is a permanent sorrow. There is a permanent, man finds himself in permanent distress. Permanent distress. And this is not just due to his environment, due to certain conditions. It is because his very being is in distress. And no one can help him. Why, for instance, certain crises can be understood by others. If I insist, people express sympathy. Someone is hungry, people will extend help to you. But there is a certain crisis of distress within them, not on the outside, to which men is, let's say, subjected, but within them, which no one understands. It is the impossibility of attaining complete success. It is the necessity for defeat from time to time. It is the necessity to share the reality of things. I don't mean physical things. It is, and this distress, this permanent distress, state of distress, is that prevails as long as man is man. Because most you humanitas, most, so to say, singularity expresses itself. And one of the basic aspects of this permanent distress is the aloneness of man. And here comes prayer. If you want to alleviate, come to God. That's why it cannot be alleviated. I'll show you how it expresses itself in the law. And they say, whoever does not feel himself and feel that he is in distress, in this permanent distress, experiencing distress, experiencing incompleteness, experiencing, how to say, I mean, the crisis, he can never meet God. The vision of God is shut out of his world. Always a lonely place. Always in distress. Take for instance, the formulator, the aspects of this inner distress and permanent distress, what they are. But it's not the time, it comes, yes? I have to check. Excuse me for a moment. Yes. Will you be so kind and look up some 130. 130. The famous Psalm, get profundity. There's the first. Could you give me, someone give me an English text? Yes, with this kind. 130, yes? Out of the depths have I called thee, O Lord. Get profundity. What does it mean, out of the depths? What kind of depth does it speak? What kind of depth? How do we find ourselves? In my distress I called unto the Lord, and he answered me. O Lord, deliver my soul from lying lips, from a deceitful tongue. What shall be given unto thee, and what shall be done more unto thee? Thou deceitful tongue, sharp arrows of the mighty, his coat of gloom. What does it mean, out of my distress? And what is distress? He doesn't specify anything here. Sickness, hunger, war. What is that? The lying tongue. The lying lips and the deceitful tongue. Who is lying? Who is lying? Where did he see liars around himself, David? Are there so many liars in the world? Everybody's a liar. Call out and crazy. Why is he a liar? Because then he displays sympathy from him. For the Tao, he basically does not feel the Tao. The Tao is not real to him. Is the Tao real to him? When he comes to express our condolences, face of death, when he comes to visit the sick, is the Tao real to me? As a rabbi, I do many. I visit the sick, and of course, I pay many visits of condolence. So is the distress of the other fellow real to me? Nothing. Then I say, I'm sorry, and I have sympathy. It's lying grief. It's a deceitful part. Because the feet is a part of man, because it's wrong. There's no understanding of the other on the part of the other one. And this is the permanent distress in which man lies in time. And of course, the more mother man becomes, the smoother he talks, the richer his vocabulary is, and the easier he can roll up sentences, the bigger a lot of it is, of course. The Lord deliver me, my soul, and there's no indictment upon us. Because I'm the same way I am. Because I'm lonely, he's lonely. I'm very particular. This is the basic element which is overlooked in modern prayer. The basic element, yes, sir.
Why is the meaning required
is
prayer a question of the individual
thing
alone?
Do you know what the meaning is required, logically, for the saying of the Kaddish? And for the recital of the Kedusha, it means for the hymn, but not for the intercessory prayer. The singing of what is Kaddish? Kaddish means the singing of the hymn. The hymn, glorified and exalted be his name, for Kadosh, 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 Sanctum, Sanctum, Sanctum. It's the hymn, for the hymn, but not for the intercessory prayer. The hymn, of course, thanksgiving, this glorious tone of hymn and music is much nicer than the rhythm. What then man comes to surrender to God, to hide his head in the lap of God, and say, everybody betrayed me, even father and mother have forsaken me. You are my only friend I have because you are loving kind. You understand each other. There's no meaning of the question.
The tradition of son not following father like an aliyah, that follows what you said before that father?
No, it's a different reason. The reason is because whoever is called up for the aliyah testifies that the Torah is good. And the law is that two relatives are disqualified from testifying. Well, so if you call up the father and the son, so they cannot testify. You can call the Jewish law, two witnesses must testify in order to confirm something. The testimony of one witness is not enough. So then you call up the first one and the second one, so both testify. Torah Temet is the true Torah. But father and son can never testify together. This is it. Because Kriyas HaTorah is not prayer, I want to say. It's a star, it's not prayer. It's a Kriyas at a different level. Kriyas HaTorah is basic star. There is a combination of prayer and a star, it's a different level.
Where is your evidence about father and son not praying together?
In Ramo, in Italy, in the Shuknaos and the Copts, he said that one should not embrace the child, or even pet his child, or even look at his child, caress his child with a glance during prayer, because it should be because Kyoji has won every Shani Asani, because everybody is forsaken except that. It's simple, clear, tart law in the court. I don't remember now the paragraph, but next time I'll be, I'll write you a letter, I'll be able to.
No, just wondering,
yes.
Prayer is, in the prayer book, it can be very stock. Everyone can say the word.
Correct.
The question of
some of
the prayer. I'm just wondering, there's famous friends where there's a silence of prayer.
Yeah, I know. It's silence of prayer among the prayers. We know basic knowledge of understanding. We are getting away from our topic. Basically, prayer is what we call in the Lakic terminology avodah shebalev. It is service by the heart. This, so to say, this physical act of pronouncing words is more a medium, a technique, can be very expert prayer. The vice versa prayer was introduced is my mind is explained, because simple people don't know how to express. And in order to make prayer democratic, there is an element of democracy, and my mind is explained. For the man, the literate person, it is such useful prayer. This was before Ezra from the Great Assembly. The person who is stuttering and stuttering, but the man has no language, the primitive person couldn't pray. So in order to get, as I tell you, Judaism is also an institutionalized religion. As an institutionalized religion, it has to reckon with the need of the letter. And you cannot keep something at a lofty level and simply doubt the method from participating. That's why prayer has been summarized, but the experience of prayer has never been summarized. It shouldn't be summarized.
Well, if that is so, certainly the prayers that are recited are far in terms of our tongue today.
What do you mean, so, in the experience of language?
Yes.
You mean language simply because it's Hebrew and English?
That's like a kind of translation.
Yeah, I'll tell you. I mean, basically, prayer can be recited in every language. You know, that's the biblical text that there. It's Luach. Yes, prayer can be the basic line that prayer can be recited in every language in which a person speaks.
However, I mean, I would recommend that people should study prayers in Hebrew, because there it's very hard to translate something. I showed you a chod. A chod has not been translated as a chod. It's lonely, I mean, it's hard to translate. There is no genuine translation for it.
What? Why shouldn't you expect the translation, the Lord, our God, the Lord is one, instead of saying the Lord is our God, the Lord is one? Which would you expect them to be more likely at the translation?
I would agree, I've never thought about it, but I would agree more that the Elohim is a qualifying, is a clause. It means the Lord our God.
The Lord,
as a qualifying, as a clause in common. I would put it in common. As a clause, I would put it as a clause. Yes, sir.
The concept that you give of the Torah,
yes.
It's, for a moment, it sounds, at first blush, anti-psychological,
in the sense that it is an unchanging, immutable Torah that responds not to changes of social conditions. Yeah, I wouldn't say that. I wouldn't say that it's immutable or unchangeable altogether. But of course, for instance, the way I experience it is dependent upon the general cultural constellation and my position within society, of course. But all I'm saying is that everybody must experience incompleteness in itself. Incompleteness and also failure. Defeat at a certain level. Body levels change, and the terms of the experiential terms in which I may interpret it, certainly are subject to cultural change. But I say you can never, so to say, redo yourself from this. It is permanent, it cannot be. But let me speak about longer. If I may just... Now, let us see what is longer, basically. What is longer? We spoke about it, but still we didn't define it. You know all that very well, that only in men is long. The lion, the horse, or the cat is not long. You know this now. It's hard to say, but let's assume so.
As much as the humane society is trying to tell us what is humane, what or what is inhumane. I asked one of the leaders, did you interview the animal? How does he know?
It is the fall, which is an inseparable part, as I said. Of our existential world, not our mind. Let us see. And please, I would ask you to pay attention. I begin to bore now, and the family bore, but for a while, just for a short while. While the whole universe shares only surface existence with man, only surface existence, the human being lays claim to a depth existence as well. And I'll explain. It's fully attributes, for instance, reality. a certain object, a particular object, such as a stone in the inanimate world, or the animal in the organic zoological kingdom, or the smite of the grass, or the book. We say the stone exists. What do you understand by saying the stone exists? That this glass of water is water is not water is real or this. So all we say is it exists at a behavioral level. Only. Or in so far as the as this object is affected or and by and affecting change in others. It means this object can be affected by some action, or can also affect action in others. It means in terms of causality. The stone exists and its reality is equal. You ask whether the reality of the stone is equal, the mathematical equation. What would you say? This is some total of matter and energy, that's all. You wrote about the book of physics and say this is some total of matter and energy. Of course, is equal to the behavior of some total or its position within the causal nexus. It exists as much as much action we cannot try to it. Whatever the stone is betrayed and expressed by its activity. It exists outside, on the surface. Because it may affect changes in other objects, it may also be affected by the impact of other objects. And of course, the fact that it is affected, these objects are affected, it affects changes in other objects, because it's easy. Because at least the causal nexus is a continuous one, any change here, I mean, involves the change that is there. It exists outside, on the surface. Expressed in mathematical equations as mass and energy. There is no existence to be attributed to the stone other than one manifested in its causal relational behavior, in its activity.
God, I cannot say activity of the stone, but in its effectiveness.
Whatever the stone is, its whole existence is exhausted by its relatedness to others. The stone alone doesn't exist. It can live as a cause and an effect within the whole of the cosmic drama. And this is true not only of the soul in the book, it's true of the stars and the sun, of animate and inanimate nature.
Therefore, to make scientific observations of things, such dead things, or even of animals, a particular of dead things, is epistemologically a simple task. Of course, it might be associated with technical difficulties, particularly at the microscopic level, but there is one thing which is true. The stone doesn't lie, does it? Or the animal doesn't lie if the stone is interviewed. I mean interview not in the sense of a dialogue, but I mean interviewed in the laboratory, under the microscope or wherever it is. It doesn't lie. Whatever the scientist observes is true. And this is why the natural scientists are so fortunate that they can predict with exactness the behavior of the stars and the moon and of the stone and of the drop of water for a simple reason, because those objects don't lie. And why don't they lie? What is lying mean? Lying means my behavior is something else and my within existence is not commensurate with my within existence. There is no within existence in the stone. Whatever it is, this is expressed to others.
Nothing is hidden in the thing itself, beyond its behavioral surface. There are no indentations in the stone, indentations, or obtuse corners,
no secrets, nothing. There is sometimes secrets in matter, but finally we get out of it. And how do we get out?
We observe, I mean, the behavior of matter.
How do we get out, I mean, the secret of the subatomic structure? By a bit of light. When an atom gets off the orbit, there is an optical effect. And this is true, because the atom would not fly fast. However, many different.
It certainly exists like other things, of course,
and we can understand man by his behavior. Certainly.
Within which, he finds himself on par with other things,
of the defunct order, within which he finds himself placed, namely on the outside. He also lives on the outside. We live through our talking, how people know about us, and our speech, our actions, our reactions, responses, our endeavors, and so forth, and yet so.
When we also equate human existence with his deportment, right? And dismiss the other existential aspects completely.
As a matter of fact, I am not speaking such truthful to my head.
As a matter of fact, many psychologists have done so when as eo ipso,
and they've equated men with his behavior. All psychology of behavior is like so. So the psychology of, what do you call it, of association?
Spencer, yes, many of them, in particular in America, behavior is.
So what is the psychology of behaviorism say? What is man?
It's some sort of like his activity.
That means man is an outside existence. He has no within existence, or if perhaps he has, but he is not interested. Say it the way he did that.
But that's all. But of course, by this statement, they destroy the very concept of the human personality and its unique station within the realm of things. We, advocates of religious anthropology, in particular of Judaism, the important world where Judaism was great, revolutionary, know that there is more to man than his instinctive behavior betrays.
There is more to man than his actions tell us. There is nothing more to the stone than his behavior. There is more to man than his behavior. There is more to man than his work. Man is greater than his work. While the stone is not greater than his actions.
This strange being possesses not only surface, but also depth of existence. In water,
or I would say within center place,
in within center place, or self-containment, self-concentration, which does never express itself through automatic compulsive activity that is limited to the outside. There is always more to personality than its active participation in the order of things or its active contribution to society. There is more to personality.
The causal relational order encompasses man, yes, as well as other existences, animal, plant, and mineral.
Yet while the latter, the other animal, plant, and mineral, are confined, the latter is confined to this series, and everything in them is poured into their functioning, man transcends this realm of mechanical existence, the realm of functionality. He is not only a member of a comprehensive dynamic system, like the animal, but he also finds his reality in immanence, in selfhood, in being rooted to within, in personal correct and richness. In an existence which cannot be exhausted in action, nor in behavior, nor in surface manifestation. There is always, you cannot say, man equals his activity. Man equals his behavior. It's a false equation.
Never mind about any metaphysics. It's a false equation. Man is always greater than his work. This thought, it is really a creative being. It's interesting, the saying, the Midrashic saying, when Moses wrote the Torah, the Samink remained in the past. The white detail on his forehead, and that's why his face began to be, the nation's face, be. What does it mean? Moses could not express himself ever. There is more to Moses than his work. And for instance, the famous Scandinavian playwright, Danish playwright, Ibsen, and there is the famous drama, Architect Solness, I believe I am quoting it correctly, Architect Solness. In America, Ibsen was never talented in the world. It was in Europe, in Western Europe, there were times when it was simply completely dominated by Ibsen and his work. Now, with the rising tide of existentialism in America, Ibsen should come there, should be treated with the life and the traveling to will. So there is Architect Solness. Ibsen describes an architect. Ibsen's people in general are very weak people. Not great characters. Particularly the men. The women are much stronger, more possessive and domineering than men. I don't know, perhaps beauty is
child with the state of his mother and father. I don't know anything. Hello. So in architect Solis, Ibsen describes the great architect, the genius, who used to build all the churches, particularly the Gothic architecture. The architect of the Gothic architecture expresses men's desire for infinity, men's surging upward. I mean, men's this demonic gesture to encompass the universe, but to get into heaven. This is basically the Gothic architecture. So what I mean actually Spengler or whatever is after this day. So he was a genius in designing such churches with this pyramid, tower, and so forth. But he never dared to climb the tower he built. And this is the tower when he began to climb the tower he built, any tower he built, the beautiful tower used to get easy. So finally some woman persuaded him. What do you want? Because he could design beautiful towers, he could never fill the house. Which did work, actually. And this is what Judaism says it's for. If one is an architect, so he's greater than his design. This is exactly what Judaism would violently do. The creator is always greater than his creation. And again, because man was created in the image of God. And what is greater? God and his creation than the universe. Of course, God is greater. And man is created in the image of God. So man is greater than it. If this architect, particular architect, can build such power, and shooting forth into heaven, he can do it. Otherwise, he wouldn't have done it. As Moses. It's exactly what the Midrash said about Moses. He was greater than his past. His son is outside existence.
Of course, this unique existence cannot be just observed.
This unique existence, the within existence, not the surface existence.
But the depth existence cannot be just observed in a manner reminiscent of Galileo's watching an object fall from the tower of Pisa.
Because for simple reason. Because there is something which is not such
to observation. But the art of thought will, in relation to such observation, attain important data concerning the outside existence of man. But no glimpse into the depth of the personality will be afforded. The latter cannot be exposed
and cannot be actually expressed. Only, how can I actually, if I want to know your natural thought, I can first observe you, I mean, and I can make my deductions, some observations. I can observe you the way you use your movements, your speech. I mean, the handwriting and so forth. I mean, I can make certain deductions. Reduction will be just, I mean, it's research. Then I equate, I mean, your existence with your activity, like you saw. But I want to get a little bit deeper into you. So how, what can you do? You know that, I mean, social workers is certain, it's an interview business. What does an interview mean? I don't observe. I may observe during the interview, but this is not the main purpose of the interview. Interview means revelation. I have to ask the person to reveal himself to me. Otherwise, what is analysis? Revelation. There is something new which I cannot observe. But he has to reveal. It's an extra way of communication. Reveal means free communication. And I am always at liberty either to divulge communication or to test on information. And here is where man is a liar. It's how to trust him. The stone doesn't have to communicate. I left the information from the stone. Because the activity is subject to observation. I cannot drag it from a person because the person has the within centeredness. The within centeredness cannot be dropped. I cannot observe. He has to communicate.
It's an act only through active communication. Through a willful bursting thought of the inmost, even hidden world of a person, it is possible to gain insight into a unique, one-timely, self-existence, which is focused not on the outside, but in itself. In short, just as the existence cannot be captured by an observer, he makes that confession.
Basically, this is confession. Any interview
is a confession. I ask, is a confession. When this mysterious personality steps freely closer to the surface and tries to reveal itself to the dull, when the eye turns from inner repose, toward the outside, then something internate breaks through the crust of the surface and makes itself known to the other person. The parallelism is between divine revelation and human revelation. How does Judaism say, how do we know God? God revealed himself. If God had willed to reveal himself, we wouldn't have known it. A person cannot know a person unless he reveals it. The stone doesn't have to reveal it. And of course, however, this process of communication is never an adequate one, gentlemen. The personal existence is unique, intimate, and strange. And it's very peculiarly felt and experienced by the eye. The dull can never share intimate experience of the eye. It is insolubly bound up with the self. Only the eye knows himself as a self. And the knower, basically, is incommunicable to others. This is basically what Judaism stressed. Even when the eye is, so to say, frank, and truthful, and wants to confide in you, and tries to reveal to the Tao the inward existence, the self, even when he makes an honest effort to bear his soul, he can never transcend the threshold of loneliness, to transfer experiences, bring and interweave them into the existential texture of others. All he does is in a moment of frank confession and confidential communication is easy employees.
How does a person confess?
If I could tear my heart and say it is anathema and let other people take a look at my heart, perhaps it could find me. But how do I confess?
How do I pour my heart? Through what
media?
Language. What is language? Language is not an individual medium. Language is a universal symbol.
My language is nothing unique about language, you see. After all, I employ the behavioral language of the surface, the sounds and metaphors, an outside existence in which an outside existence expresses itself, in activities, in manifestations, in words. And it's impossible for words to express whatever is within me, because the word is a standardized medium already. It's not a unique medium. The latter, the I, is mute. And remains a personal mystery, a perennial mystery to the outside world. Communication and self-revelation is to be considered as a noble attempt at self-transcendence. No one wants to transcend himself and reveal himself to us. However, a full communication is unattainable. The fullness of one's being, of one's personality, of his existential experience, will never be perceived by others. All a person can communicate to them are symbols and signs, and symbols and signs which do not reflect this loneliness of man, meaning his uniqueness of man. And actually, the man remains in seclusion as an individual singular being. Only those, you see, take for instance, psychoanalysis. Psychoanalysis also talks about the subconscious and unconscious. But basically, with psychoanalysis, everything is expressive. All right, memory practices and experiences, but you can bring them to the surface by certain methods. We say there is something in man which is inaccessible, not subconscious. It's the man is conscious. You have to say, the man is conscious. Not subconscious. That's the subconscious too, but he doesn't care about it. The Judaism did not deal with this problem. He's conscious of it. So it's his exclusive possession. He cannot make this treasure available to us. He cannot express itself. let us fool ourselves. I mean, in our daily intercourse with people, I mean, we find it. This is solitude. There are aspects of the personality which cannot be translated into universal experiences, standardized feelings, and awareness they have. We cannot be transformed by individuals, his fellow man. And these are confined to the depth of personality. This is exactly what Schumann thought. So actually, now, let us see. This is loneliness. Loneliness means to begin existence. If a person would have only a surface existence, he would never be lonely. But he could communicate with others, he would have no need for communication. It would have been, observed, captured by others, by just looking at him. But since he has to communicate his inner experiences, he cannot communicate. So he's lonely. There is a mystery within existence which does not fit him into community. So the community can only consist as people with something in common which can communicate to each other what they have. But if each one of us has something which you cannot communicate, which cannot be perceived by others, it is an individual heart, of course, sounds strange and uncommonly. Of course, in left the car, the will show you this sound of your heart. Yes, I'm just talking to metaphor. But how the heart, my rhythm of the heart, it's only I feel, no one else. This is a contamination. No left the car, you can get a picture. It is a communicating gesture of men who want to join their other selves.